I will call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 24th, 2023. A quorum is present. First item of business is approval of the minutes of March 23rd, 2023. Representative Curran, will you move the minute?
So moved, Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the minutes of March 23rd? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right, the first bill we're going to take up today is House File 282. Representative Frazier, would you like, Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move to recommend that House File 282 be referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, the bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2, well, let me start here. Historically, we have anecdotally had information that within our state and also around the country, most of our traffic stops have been disproportionately targeted towards certain community groups. What we have not had, and particularly in the state of Minnesota, is data from all jurisdictions statewide to collect and evaluate to find ways to enact policies that would deal with those disparities, and also just to show that those disparities are in fact happening. House File 282 will allow us to collect that data, and it will allow us to collect that data by allowing for an option to provide your racial and ethnic background on your driver's license. The data will still maintain its privacy rating under the Minnesota Data Privacy Act, but it will allow for that information to be shared with the Department of Public Safety to run reports on a year-in, year-out basis to determine if there are, in fact, disproportionalities in terms of the traffic stops that are happening, and then that information will also be allowed to be shared with local jurisdictions to provide them with information to aid in any policy development to ensure that those type of disparities in traffic stops are not actually happening. That is the bill, Madam Chair. And I do have a testifier here to speak more to the details from the Department of Vehicle Services, and there are folks here from, come on down. But Madam Chair, I will yield there, let my testifier speak more to it, and I will be here for questions.
All right, I've got Director Zhang. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division, and I'm here in support of House File 282, which allows for the collection of race and ethnicity data on the credential. And thank you, Representative Frazier, for carrying this bill. He already eloquently described what this bill does, and I just want to reaffirm that this data is optional, and once it's collected, it will be classified as private data, which will be available in summary form for all sorts of I think, you know, appropriate inquiries for where race, ethnicity, and the driving credential cross. And it does provide a provision for us to provide the data to the Office of Traffic Safety, which will give more specific information that will allow the information to be cross-referenced to actual citations. And with that, I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Don't have anyone else signed up ahead of time. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Vice Chair Frazier, closing comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope that silence means members are saying it is time that we have a tool like this so that we can have informed information and evidence when we craft policies to deal with some of the inequities we have in our state. I think it's a good bill. Hope for your support.
All right. Vice Chair Frazier renews the motion to recommend that House File 282 be re-referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. And Vice Chair Frazier, I'm not sure if your testifier is here for your other bill, so we might move things.
One is, do you want to?
Oh, there we go. All right. Vice Chair Frazier, we will do House File 1406. Would you like to move to recommend that House File 1406 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. The bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Madam Chair, members, House File 1406 seeks to reform our felony murder aid and abetting law. Currently in Minnesota, people can be charged with and convicted of murder even though they did not kill anyone, nor intend for anyone to die, or anticipate that that death would occur. This is because of our aiding and abetting homicide laws. In 2021, a legislative task force including county attorneys, police chiefs, victim advocates, impacted people, public defenders, and other experts examined Minnesota's aiding and abetting felony murder doctrine, compared it to other states, and looked at patterns on who was charged and punished under the doctrine. What they learned was the impact of our current law has been uneven. It disproportionately impacts young people, women, and people of color. 56% of those charged are under the age of 25, 48% charged are black, 80% of those convicted are people of color, and the majority of those impacted have little or no criminal history. In short, this law has a significant and disproportional life-changing impact on certain populations of our state. House File 46 is a result of the work of the task force, and House File 46 will put the recommendations of the work of the task force into law. Those recommendations are as followed: revising relevant statutes such that those who aid and abet felonies are not liable for murder where the aider and abettor did not A, kill another, B, otherwise contribute to the homicidal acts of another while intending to kill, nor act with reckless disregard for human life as a major participant in a felony where a murder where a human died. Also, revise relevant statutes such that people previously convicted of aiding and abetting felony murder may petition the court for release. Also, implementing reforms beyond mere adoption of an affirmative defense for aiding and abetting felony murder. And then also expanding the task force mandate and timeline to undertake similar work as it applies to Minnesota's felony murder doctrine and or aiding and abetting liability generally. I do have one member of the task force here to help with any questions if needed. And I would like to thank Chair Kelly Moeller for the work that she's done on this over the years. It's been a work in progress. But it has been with bipartisan support. The Senate bill is moving with bipartisan support, and I expect that this bill will have bipartisan support as it has in the past. Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Okay. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Vicker Finn, Representative Frazier. In the bill, I see there's a where a person not already convicted of aiding and abetting can go back and revisit it. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once this bill is put into law, an individual that is currently incarcerated for aiding and abetting would be able to petition to the court to have their matter reviewed to see if it falls under the new standards for felony murder, aiding and abetting. And if it is determined that it is, they will sentence and charges and convictions will be adjusted accordingly.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Frazier, thank you for that explanation. Next question I have dealing with that, if they look back, they were charged under different elements of the crime. If they look back at the court record, some of those elements might not even been looked at. Mm-hmm. With these changes in element that they have to prove, are they going to have a new trial or try to figure out if the elements of the crime, they just happened in the case to see the elements of the crime that they had?
I do have some of the folks that help draft this language that we're part of the task force, a couple of attorneys here, that this is their bailiwick. Representative Johnson, could you repeat the Madam Chair?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, Representative Johnson, if you could repeat the question while the other testifiers here are listening to you.
Looking at the Chair Becker Finn, Representative Frazier, and the testifiers, looking at the bill, the elements of the crime that they were convicted of is different than the new elements of the crime because it changed things. They might not have looked at, or in the court trial, even looked at these elements. Is that going to create where just about everyone has to have a new trial?
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then
Hello.
Go ahead with your answer.
My name is Perry Moriarty. I'm a law professor at the University of Minnesota, and I was a member of the task force, and my apologies for just now arriving. We're not anticipating, Representative Johnson, that there would be a need for a new trial. I may be slightly misunderstanding the question. In terms of the convictions themselves, many of them, of course, are for aiding and abetting felony murder, either first or second degree. They're pleas to, within this group, they're pleas to other offenses as well. But the anticipation is that we'll go back, and there are very specific, detailed criteria about what would trigger another look and perhaps a reexamination of the conviction. And it would depend, of course, on whether or not the applicants or petitioners could meet the elements laid out in the bill. And so there'd be a rigorous review of both the application and presumably of the trial record itself, but we're not anticipating a need for a new trial.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Frazier, and the testifier. That's the point. In that trial, these elements weren't there. Would they have even looked at these elements? Now you're having to go through you might have to do a whole new investigation because looking for these elements. When an officer does the investigation, they're looking at the elements of the crime, they're getting as much detail as possible. And in the court hearing, it's where they go through the elements. Now you've changed the elements, and it could cause some issues.
Response, Professor Moriarty.
Chair Beckerfin, thank you. And thank you, Representative Johnson. I'm sorry, I wasn't sure I understood the question the first time around. I mean, and there are county attorneys here who may be able to speak to this even better than I, having not been a county attorney. But presumably, all of the evidence that supported the initial conviction was brought forward and was investigated. The question really is whether our laws, as applied, even under those circumstances, were fair and were actually yielding convictions and sentences that were proportional. So I don't believe that there's concern that the evidence would not have been unearthed or investigated to begin with. I think the real question is, as enforced, were the laws necessarily meeting the right convictions and the right sentences for the right people? Or were there people that had lesser roles and really didn't have an opportunity under our laws to be held accountable for those lesser roles because of the way the laws have operated? And I believe that's how, one thing I might add is that, you know, this has happened in a number of other states. In particular in California, I think there are many more people who fall under these laws and the retroactivity provisions, and I'm not aware of any new trials. I'm aware of a reassessment of the overall culpability of the actors.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin and to the testifier. I'm not sure if this retroactive part fits the same as California, but I know what this says. And when you go to appeal a case or something, you don't look at new evidence, you look at what was in the courts, what was done during the court hearing. Mm-hmm. There might be stuff in the reports and stuff that meet these elements, but if they weren't used in court, they couldn't be used in the appeal process.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, the idea of this is that with the retroactivity piece is to give individuals that were charged under the current statutes that we have now the ability to go back through this petition process to look at the facts of that case. And if you apply the facts to the new standards and they find that that individual was not a major participant or did not actually participate in the cause of a death in the carrying out of this felony, then there will be an adjustment based on that. And that decision can be made based on the evidence that is already in the record, because presumably that evidence would have been provided to the prosecution in order to make that initial charge and take that case to trial and present that evidence, or to give that initial charge, and then often, in most cases, lead to a plea agreement. So the evidence will be there. It will be the same evidence. It will just be applied under these different standards.
Final follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Frazier. I understand what you're saying, but also I've been in court and understand the appeals process as well. But in the appeals process, looking at the retroactivity, they only can use the evidence that was entered into court. With different elements being used for the crime, there's no guarantee that the elements were actually used in court to actually use the records. That's my problem with the retroactivity. I guess maybe at some point we just have to agree to disagree on this one, but that's the concerns I have.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, are we not doing the DE? I'm just curious.
Vice Chair Frazier.
We're not doing the DE. The DE would align this bill with the Senate. There were some changes made. Many of those changes we do like and we accept, but there are some pieces that we want to iron out some language on, so we're gonna take care of it in conference committee.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Further discussion to the bill. Closing comments, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for the questions. Representative Johnson, I think we can talk more, because I think we do. I think there is an answer and an understanding we can get to as to how that part works, and I think we can talk more about that. I think you've been a little bit I think you've been supportive of this in the past. Am I remembering that right?
Representative Johnson.
No. <I'm not. laughs> Chair Becker Finn, I think there were some things I did, but in the past it needed quite a bit of tweaking.
Yeah, and I know in the past we have had Republican co-authors mm-hmm. of the bill on the House side as well. So, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm going to get you there. We'll get there. appreciate the honesty. This is time. Most countries have abolished this doctrine. Almost all 50 states within our country are moving in a way to do some revisions to this, so that we are getting the folks that are most culpable for these crimes when they're committed. And it's time for Minnesota to move in that direction. So I would appreciate the support of the members.
All right. We'll renew Vice Chair Frazier's motion to recommend that House File 1406 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. Next up, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. I will move to recommend that House File 1520 be placed on the General Register.
Okay. Long time no see.
Representative, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an A2 amendment. Would you like me to move the A2?
Yes, please.
All right, I will move the A2 amendment. Could you just tell us briefly what the A2 does?
Certainly. Good later morning. House File 1520. Thank you so much for your time and your attention today. The A2 really just gives some technical and clarifying language.
All right. All those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you. Well, thanks again. I'm very excited to be presenting this bipartisan bill that really just lays out expectations for consumers as well as the direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies. These are companies like Ancestry, 23andMe are kind of the two big ones that come to my mind. This was really fun for me to kind of dig into with my genetics background. It has also been in collaboration with the industry, with privacy advocates, and as well as with house reps who are very skilled in data privacy. I've been able to incorporate most of the feedback, so I'm very proud and I continue to have conversations. With this type of testing, people choose to participate in this market and they give their genetic data. So this bill includes separate consents for each part of the process, down to collecting the genetic data tissues like your blood or your spit, to analyzing it, to interpreting it, to storing it, to using it for research. Like every step of the process you have to give a consent for. It does include de-identification, which happens when you opt in for research, and that language, the language in the bill aligns with the Federal Trade Commission as well as Common Rule. I know we are want to be efficient and effective with time, so I do have a couple testifiers to further describe some of the meat.
All right. I've got Richie Engelhart and Jackie Haggerty. You can go ahead and pull another chair up. Director Engelhart, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Richie Engelhart. I'm the head of government affairs at Ancestry, here today in strong support of HF 1520 by Representative Hemmings and Yeager. Work on this bill dates back to 2017 when the Future of Privacy Forum, a leading privacy nonprofit in D.C., convened consumer and privacy advocates, medical ethicists, companies, and legislators on the Hill. Together, they developed a privacy best practices document that includes what we believe are the appropriate guidelines for DTC genetic testing services. When states looked to regulate our industry a few years later, those best practices were translated into bill form, and that bill is what is before you today, with some changes as requested by members of the Minnesota legislature. This approach has broad bipartisan support and stakeholder support. Since 2021, six states have enacted similar laws, including Arizona, California, Kentucky, Maryland, Utah, and Wyoming. Aside from Minnesota, 10 other states have similar measures in progress this year, with a bill in Virginia already sitting on the governor's desk. And I'm going to turn it over to my colleague from 23andMe, who will next lay out the bill's provisions.
Jackie Haggerty, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. I'm Jackie Cook Haggerty, and I'm the General Counsel and Privacy Officer of 23andMe, and also here today in strong support of HF 1520 by Representative Hemmings and Yeager. The bill provides robust protections for consumers, including a requirement that consumers provide separate express consents, meaning companies cannot bury these consents in terms of service or privacy policies. This is required for any collection, processing, or sharing of their genetic data. Specifically, the bill requires separate express consent for each of the following: analyzing the consumer's biological sample, in the case of both our companies, that is a saliva sample, storing the consumer's biological sample after it's been analyzed for additional testing opportunities. And I'll note that this is completely optional. The consumer can say no to that biological sample storage and still participate in the company's services. Viewing of genetic relatives on our websites requires a separate consent, and both parties must each consent before any matches are revealed on our websites. Using a consumer's genetic data for any marketing purpose, sharing their data with any third party, and finally a separate consent is required for research. And if a consumer opts in for research, they must agree to an informed consent that explains the benefits and risks of the research, the same as any clinical trial that's conducted in the United States. Aside from the consents that we must collect from consumers, they're empowered to delete their data at any time, and if they chose to have their biological sample stored, they can opt to have that destroyed as well at any time. They can end their relationship with our companies at any time by closing their accounts, and their information and samples would be deleted. HF 1520 puts these protections into law, outlining responsibilities for direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies to Minnesota consumers and clearly explaining the rights that they have when they engage with these types of services to learn more about their genealogy and their health. While Ancestry and 23andMe have adhered to these practices, HF 1520 will ensure that every direct-to-consumer genetic testing service is held to the same standards for privacy and data protection. Our consumers' trust is our top priority. If they don't trust us, they're not going to use our services, plain and simple. We urge a favorable report on HF 1520 and welcome any questions that the committee may have.
All right, thank you for your testimony. I also have another public signed up, Twyla Brace. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Can I pass up my testimony to a page?
No, I haven't seen it. So that typically you would provide that to the CA ahead of time.
Okay.
But if you want to email it, we can certainly email it to members afterwards.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yep. Please proceed.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We have long supported genetic privacy. However, we are concerned that HF 1520 does not sufficiently protect privacy rights and gives a false sense of security to consumers. Line 2.25 says, quote, genetic data does not include de-identified data, end quote. This creates a loophole eliminating the bill's protections for sharing and use of de-identified data. Under this bill, the company could simply remove identifiers and then share genetic data broadly. This allows these genetic companies to commodify a consumer without their permission. Their data and their specimen do not stop being genetic data just because the law says it isn't. Furthermore, DNA can never be anonymized. Even 23andMe says in the event of a breach of de-identified data, a person could potentially be identified by using a public database. Note that Amendment A2 only protects and refers to a subset of genetic data, that which is classified as genetic data. Thus, we ask that line 2.25 be deleted from the bill or that the word not be struck. Finally, in line 5.31, it references the Code of Federal Regulations. This is far less protective than the strong privacy-protecting Minnesota Health Records Act, and it could even threaten current protections over all patient data. We ask that it refer to the MHRA instead. In consideration of genetic privacy rights, we are asking you to make these changes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we do have another amendment. I believe Representative Scott, this is your amendment. Would you like to move the A3 and tell us what it does?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A3 puts back into this law that under the definition of genetic data that it does include de-identified data. As a testifier just said, it's still your data. And it can be re-identified if there is a data breach. So I felt it was important to protect consumers by adding that.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager to the A3.
Yeah, so thank you, Representative Scott. I really appreciated our conversations, and I do appreciate kind of the spirit of this amendment. However, this is where our statutory definitions and kind of my genetics textbook definitions differ a little bit. So genetic data is spelled out and defined in statute as kind of anything that relates to the consumer that you can tie with the consumer. Should that consumer choose to opt into research, there are Federal Trade Commission guidelines. There's the Common Rule guidelines that information must be de-identified, so it's now dissociated from the consumer for that ability to be used and conducted in research. So if we were to kind of put that back under genetic data, we would actually be out of alignment with the best practices that Mr. Engelhardt described earlier. So I would respectfully request a no vote.
Any further discussion to the A3? Any closing comments on the amendment, Representative Scott?
Nope, that's it. We've had lots of good discussions over this, and we're just going to agree to disagree.
So. Got it. Well, I certainly appreciate having those conversations ahead of time and trying to at least make sure we're on the same page as the different positions. So all those in favor in the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Please say no. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. On to discussion of the underlying bill as amended by the A2. Representative.
She was
pointing to me.
Oh, it's not usually how you get on the list, Representative Niska, but.
Like you saw her when she raised her hand. Attempting to.
It's got my back.
Yeah. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. It's been a pleasure to work with you and kind of geek out on some of this stuff. And she knows what she's talking about, and we would have hoped so, since that's what she went to school for and works in that industry. So, and I want to also thank the Ancestries and 23andMe's because they have come quite a ways on the individual consent piece. I really appreciate that they made those strides towards that. I think that's a really important aspect of this bill. I do have a question for, I believe, oh, it's the person from Ancestry DNA.
Mr. Engelhardt.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Engelhardt, thank you for the conversations over the last few months on this and even in last year as well. This bill's been around for a while. And this will come to no surprise to you. You had sent me the slide deck of kind of the consent that people have to go through as they're signing up online for your services. And I had problems with line six, or slide six. And it's the DNA processing consent. And on that, I understand all the consent pieces, except when you get down to a bullet point that says that Ancestry may use my DNA data to create new product features and services, including products related to wellness and health. And I get the all the other consents that you have to process the DNA data, but that just seems to be out of place to me. That seems like that should be on another slide. Where a person would have to separately consent to having their data shared for new products, services, and features, including products for wellness and health. So I wonder if you could give some feedback on that.
Director Engelhardt.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. As I explained in my last email to you, it actually does not say wellness and health anymore. I sent you an outdated slide deck, so it just says new products and services. And the conceit of a population level genetic database is that you opt in to participate to learn more about your health or your ancestry, and the company uses the population level genetic data in order to discover additional things. We are constantly learning that certain genes are from certain parts of the world and how they've migrated over time. That's what the consumer signed up for. So every year we do an ethnicity update, and some of the most passionately interested emails I get are right after those ethnicity updates come out, because they're like, it said I was 25% Greek and now I'm only, you know, 15% Greek. It's like, yes, but you're now 10% Aegean Islands. So we've actually refined that by doing that research to refine the product for the consumer. I also noted in our exchange that every major Minnesota company has similar language in their terms of service. Companies constantly have a feedback loop for how their products are working to refine those products and make sure they are performing as designed. Medtronic, for example, has this language in their terms of service. And God forbid if I ever need a heart stent or some kind of implant, I want to make darn sure that Medtronic has looked at the data from all of the customers before to make sure that's performing as expected before it goes into my chest. Right? So this is not anything that is uncommon. It is very boilerplate language in any privacy statement.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. I just felt like that seemed like it was a little out of place compared to everything else that was being addressed on that page, so thank you for addressing that. Yeah. And then my final question would go to the bill's author. And we have this thing in Minnesota called the Minnesota Health Records Act, and it is a better privacy protection than HIPAA. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on inserting that. I think it was into page 5.
Representative Benson Yeager.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've actually been talking with our nonpartisan research just to make sure that I want to make absolutely sure that before we put that in that we're not going to open up an unintended can of worms. So that is something I'm still open to putting in there if it would help clarify some things and not also put a barrier to the marketplace so people can still partake in this type of product and testing.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't know if House Research might be prepared to answer that question, how that, if we put a reference to the Minnesota Health Records Act, how that piece would layer in with the rest of the bill.
Madam Chair and members, so this gets to the limitations subdivision on the bill that begins at page 5, line 29. So the point of this bill is to regulate direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies, so it doesn't regulate any genetic testing that's ordered by a healthcare provider, a health clinic, or a hospital system. So that's why the first clause there in the limitation subdivision says that this section does not apply to protected health information that's collected by, and this references HIPAA-covered entities, so that includes, you know, doctors, healthcare plans, and things like that. The Minnesota Health Records Act is also sort of a parallel health protection law that Minnesota has, and it is more restrictive than HIPAA in terms of what it allows a healthcare provider to disclose. But for purposes of the limitations paragraph here, the scope of the two would be about pretty much the same, because you're just really what you're saying with either a reference to the Health Records Act or a reference to HIPAA here is the bill saying that it doesn't apply to doctors, to healthcare providers, hospitals, and it doesn't apply to genetic testing that's performed by healthcare providers. I hope that sort of clarifies things in general.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you. And so I think that was informative, and maybe we can talk later about that. But those were the only questions I had, Madam Chair. And again, I just appreciate working with our new genetic geek on in the legislature. Super excited to have her here. And thank you for the line of questioning.
We have we now know Representative Cha is a farmer, and we may have had conversations about this issue before, but this is the first time we've had a member of the legislature who really is an expert on genetics. So it is super helpful to have you carrying this bill. Any final comments, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for all of your kind words, and I look forward to talking about DNA with everybody, right? Okay. So again, thank you for your attention. Just want to reiterate that this these types of testing are not for health-related reasons. If you ever needed genetic testing for a health condition, you would do that through your primary care provider in a very different space. So again, just want to say thank you and to reiterate, too, that this does have support from the Future of Privacy Forum, who wrote the best practices. I've also been in touch with the Department of Commerce, and they are confident that they can also take on this extra load should anything negative happen, and that's indicated with the lack of impact on the fiscal note. I really appreciate kind of all of this discussion and allowing me to nerd out. This is actually why I kind of got into politics, is I saw that law was not keeping up with the technology. So the ability now for me to be a part of that just makes me feel very proud. So thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House Bill 1520 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Next up, we've got Representative Bierman, House File 402. I will move to recommend that House File 402 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Bierman, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Looks like almost everybody's eyes are open this morning. Good to see you all. members and Madam Chair, House File 402 encompasses three main issues: the return of charitable assets in certain circumstances, the impact of mergers and acquisitions of healthcare entities on public interest and public health across the state, and number three, the issue of health maintenance organizations' conversions from nonprofit to profit. Madam Chair, the jurisdiction of this committee pertains to Subdivision 5 in the Merger Section, Section 4 in the HMO Division. Research from the Milman Institute and many other sources have repeatedly shown consolidation of healthcare systems result in higher prices for patients, less access when local essential services are reduced, often resulting in longer travel times to reach services. House File 402 will set some standards from which to gauge the value of a merger to the public interest by positing a few fundamental questions. The first being, will a merger or acquisition be in the public interest? Meaning, will it improve access, quality health outcomes, while moderating the unsustainable growth of healthcare costs? These are measurable and desirable outcomes for all of our constituents, no matter where you live. 29 states have some level of oversight of medical merger transactions. In Minnesota, the fact is we cannot rely solely on Federal Trade Commission watchdogs or our Attorney General to monitor anti-competitive and charitable asset violation alone to provide either insight nor oversight of our medical care landscape in today's environment. Our oversight in Minnesota on mergers is very limited. Mergers and acquisitions are too often viewed simply as a business transaction. Now, I know there are many who believe that the market cures all ills. I think anyone serving on health committees or the public that you all speak to on a regular basis would acknowledge that there are gaps, that our healthcare system needs work, reform, and change. Many people up here at the Capitol, my colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, I've heard them say the system is broken. Bill 402 provides an opportunity to gather the data and build a system based on better health and ensuring the public interest in health care. Madam Chair, I'd like to call testifiers, please.
All right, I've got Justin Stofren and Ben Baglio. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. Director Stofren, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and committee members. My name is Justin Stofren. I'm the anti-monopoly director for the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization representing family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities in Minnesota. Excuse me. Our members care about this legislation because mergers raise the cost of health care, and pertinent to this committee's jurisdiction, over the last several decades, court interpretation and lax enforcement have left our state and federal antitrust laws under a mountain of bad case law that's made it exceedingly difficult to stop bad mergers. This is particularly true in the case of cross-market healthcare mergers. This bill addresses that challenge by providing the Attorney General the ability to enforce this bill's provisions that prohibit transactions that do not serve the public interest. This legislation's enforcement provisions also give teeth to the pre-merger notification process in the legislation, which is really important to giving the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Health the time necessary to collect the information and data needed to thoroughly investigate and evaluate a transaction. Finally, there have been suggestions that time limits be placed around the Attorney General's authority under this legislation, but they'd really be contrary to the way that existing state and federal law treats mergers and consolidation in the marketplace. The state needs flexibility if it's going to protect Minnesotans from monopoly power. Finally, I want to thank Representative Bierman for his leadership on this issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Ben Baglio, and then I have Danny Ackert on deck. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn, members of the committee. My name is Ben Baglio, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents over 22,000 registered nurses working at the bedside in hospitals across Minnesota. MNA is proud to support House File 402 because it provides the Minnesota Attorney General with the authority and tools desperately needed to protect patients, communities, healthcare workers, and our entire state healthcare delivery system from the harms caused by consolidation and corporatization. We know that nationally, regionally, and right here in Minnesota, corporatization leads to vital services being stripped from rural and lower income communities, being shuttled to larger facilities further and further away. Consolidation raises prices, lowers accessibility, and is bad for patients and communities. Among other provisions in this bill, nurses support House File 402 because it establishes new safeguards at the state level for preventing harmful mergers and transactions. It outlines a comprehensive and data-informed approach, one that also smartly leverages the expertise in existing structures at MDH to get the job done. It would fix glaring holes in our state's antiquated or non-existent healthcare anti-monopoly laws, and because it would prohibit CEOs and other executives of nonprofit healthcare entities from personally benefiting financially from a healthcare merger or transaction. Opponents of this bill say this isn't needed. Existing healthcare regulations are already in place. They're quite robust. But that argument falls apart pretty quickly, because if you can currently become a multimillionaire in the state of Minnesota running a tax-exempt, nonprofit healthcare entity established with a legislatively defined purpose, which is to operate and function as a community benefit, then who are the current rules actually helping? In addition to supporting this bill, I'd also encourage members of the committee to review the report that was submitted for the record entitled Healthcare at a Crossroads, as well as our written testimony, which includes a couple of recommendations that we have for beefing up this bill. With that, I'd just like to again thank Representative Bierman for his leadership on this issue, and also Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Danny Ackert and then Matthew Bergeron on deck. And I see you're from the same organization, so I don't know if you're testifying together or separately.
Separately.
Okay. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I will be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Danny Ackert. I serve as the Director of State Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. We do not oppose protections or any type of administrative oversight on the industry and the decisions that need to be made by healthcare providers in order to sustain and maintain services across the state. As such, the intent of this bill is to make more robust protections available. However, the way that intent is manifested in the language, specifically in the jurisdiction of this bill, leaves a lot to question. In our opinion, lurches the current status of how the operations from federal and state authorities relevant to these transactions, lurches it to a different paradigm that has a lot of implications to not just hospitals, but also all healthcare providers. So as such, we believe that form must follow function, and right now the function of this bill doesn't necessarily allow for the totality of circumstances to travel forward as providers take the operations that they need to make sure that care is available. We would argue that the community benefit of having a provider is better than not having a provider if a transaction is not allowed to go through. That is a balance that we want to strike in this bill. That is a balance that we want the legislature to consider going forward. However, there are provisions in this bill that are still under operation, in our opinion. We're working with the author. He's very gracious. We trust his intent. But there are some things in this bill that go a little bit further than what we anticipated, or we feel that it meets what is currently happening and what needs to happen for care to continue. I am now done. I will turn it to my colleague and who represents MHA.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Matthew Bergeron. I'm a healthcare attorney with the law firm of Larkin Hoffman, and here today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association. My comments focus on three items specifically within the purview of this committee. First, as it relates to Chapter 13 and the Data Practices Act. The section that Representative Bierman pointed you to before talks about the classification of data being exchanged between the Department of Health and the Attorney General's office. However, while this has been talked about it many times as a fleshing out of nonprofit oversight as it relates to nonprofit transactions, the scope of the bill is much larger than that, and it's not clear on its face how this relates to Chapter 13, Section 65, and the classification of data under the Attorney General's office. The bill would require an incredible amount of reporting and some very sensitive business data analysis, internal documents, and other projections to be provided to the Attorney General's office as part of a transaction. And it's not entirely clear on its face as to how that falls into either the investigative data or non-investigative, like policy-related data in 1365. Or 13.65, excuse me. So that's just one item I want to flag. Secondly, as it relates to the timeline, after 180 days, notice is provided 180 days before a transaction is closed. This bill currently has no restriction on the authority of the Attorney General to go back and either try to enjoin or unwind a transaction. So that means years, decades later, if something that happened after this was passed was deemed to have not have been in the private or in the public interest, that would potentially create grounds for the AG's office to go back and undo something like that. I think that is a concerning for certainty in this space. And lastly, just the idea of the standard being something as amorphous as contrary to the public interest, that attempts to pull some kind of standards out of the way we look at nonprofit interactions, where they are, where there is a an exemption from taxes as it relates to a charitable purpose. That's a pretty broad and something of a moving target standard that I think is going to drive up a lot of it's going to funnel a lot of challenges and litigations in this situation, right? I mean, that's a new test and a new target to come up with. I mean, there was comments about case law under current antitrust. Well, this kind of starts that whole conversation over with a new standard for evaluating healthcare transactions, and I think that is concerning on its face. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on House File 402? Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Carroll.
Thank you. This is a question.
Representative Carroll, if you could get a little closer to the mic.
I'm sorry, yes. Thank you, Chair. And this question's for the author, Representative Bierman. Can you comment on the regulatory authority that the AG's office has now with regard to mergers, acquisitions, and oversight?
Thank you.
In relation to this bill.
Sure.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Carroll. If it would be all right, Madam Chair, since we do have a member from the AG's office here, I would like to bring them down just to comment briefly on
Representative
that.
Representative Bierman, are you able to answer the question? I've got three other bills we got to get to today.
Sure. I think she would be more succinct and give your committee a broad, succinct answer more than I would. I tend to talk a lot, so I'm trying to limit my conversation.
All right. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Conti. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. And the question was about the existing authority, I believe. Yes, for merger review, Madam Chair and Representative. So under existing law, the Minnesota Attorney General enjoys the ability to look at mergers for a couple of potential infractions. So one is to enforce the state's existing antitrust laws. We are also able to look at a portion of these kind of transactions to the extent that they touch upon nonprofit entities or charitable assets. And the office is the charities regulator in chief, so we have the ability to look at the deployment of assets to make sure that they stay in use for the benefit of Minnesotans. Under our current review paradigm, we get notice of some nonprofit transactions affirmatively. We get notice of some transactions, but it's a more ad hoc arrangement where we request additional information via civil investigative demand or letters, and there's kind of a back and forth dance that goes on. We do not get notice of a substantial chunk of important transactions at the present.
All right, Representative Carroll, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman. I'm trying to understand the different legal standards that are going to be applied to transactions, and it looks like there's maybe three somewhat related but potentially different legal transactions that this bill would apply to. A transaction. So on page 6 at the top, subdivision 3, prohibited transactions, talks about substantially lessening competition or tending to create a monopoly or monopsony. First, I just wanted to clarify when the language substantially lessen competition, would that require the court or some finder of fact, the Attorney General in the first instance maybe, but then ultimately a court to weigh pro-competitive effects of a transaction versus anti-competitive effects of a transaction, including pro-competitive effects to a consumer versus anti-competitive effects to a consumer, because that's the way that I would think about that term in antitrust law.
Madam Chair.
Well, so first of all, most of that question was really in the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. But you can go ahead and answer Representative Bierman. We've got other bills, and I don't want us to get too far in the weeds on commerce issues. Representative Bierman.
Yeah. Madam Chair, could I ask a question about that before we continue? Because
Representative Niska, you got to wait for me to. Sometimes I pause on purpose. So, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was in the Commerce Committee in a different form, I believe. If we're going to talk about the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee, I would be interested in clarification whether this bill is going to come back to the Commerce Committee, which I'm also on.
It's going to the State and Local Government Finance Committee. We amend bills all the time in order to keep things moving. The reason I pulled it into our committee, the reason that we have jurisdiction is because of the data provisions and the attorney enforcement provisions. So that's what we're going to focus on. I can't speak to what other committees are going to want to bill back or who's going to include it in their omnibus or whatever is happening. I don't know. But we aren't going to rehash all the previous conversations that have happened in other committees. Fair. Representative Niska.
Fair enough. And Madam Chair, I was interested to know if the bill author would have any insight on that.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Niska. So the question was in regards to whether the courts would be involved in this oversight, and it would not be necessarily the courts per se. It would be an internal review with the Attorney General's office. And in other states, from what I've read and seen, most of these transactions do go through with some just an eye on them, just to understand them and how they're going to fit into the market. Most transactions are not going to be denied being anti-competitive, but this is an effort to, you know, get a clearer picture of the market, and when there is one that may be injurious to the public interest and the public well-being, then those are the ones that would have a little bit more deeper dive. And maybe I'll ask Ms. Conti if she has anything to add to that. Please, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative, so this standard is coming out of about 100 years of federal antitrust law and also state antitrust law. Yes, pro and anti-competitive effects are part of that calculus. And yes, the actual implementation would be like any other law that the AG's office enforces, in that the office would be internally looking to see whether there was a case to be brought and then bringing that case to a judge.
Representative Nisbet.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman or Ms. Conti. The last question I would have is, I'd be interested in some insight into how the two standards in Subdivision 3, two sort of disjunctive standards, and then the public interest transactions contrary to the public interest standard in Subdivision 5, which, to my reading, also lists a whole bunch of factors that would seem to go into pro-competitive and anti-competitive effects. But those seem like three different, potentially overlapping, potentially conflicting standards. I'm just curious to hear what the intent is and how those different standards will fit together and when the rubber meets the road.
Ms. Conti.
Madam Chair and Representative Niska. So yes, there are a couple of standards set out. Depending on which prong of enforcement we're looking at, that is not uncommon within statutes that the AG's office enforces. So that antitrust piece out at Subdivision 3 would be enforced like other antitrust provisions. At Subdivision 4, we're looking at authority that essentially the AG's office already enjoys vis-a-vis nonprofits. So there's kind of the traditional standard there, that piece about contrary to the public interest is aligned with other states that are doing this review work. It also, I think we could, though it's not perfectly analogous, we could look to the way that the state already deals with nonprofits. So in the nonprofit space, the Attorney General's office might find discrete violations of law, perhaps, conduct that looks like a misrepresentation in the solicitation process or something like that, but then also can go to court and pursue equitable remedies, and it can ask the court to do things like place a nonprofit in receivership so that the charitable assets and the charitable mission are maintaining their integrity, right, if a board is sort of acting amorphously poorly. So that slightly looser standard corresponds with the equitable remedies that are in play there. And it is a multi-factor analysis that again, it's echoing other states, but it's also echoing authority that the AG's office already has vis-a-vis nonprofit hospitals.
Final call for Professor Nissa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any more questions. I just wanted to comment. I appreciate that a lot of the explanation, a lot of it does reference what I think is already a very robust and what has proven to be, especially in the context of the Fairview-Sanford merger, a quite robust authority by the Attorney General's office, and I worry that we're creating a little bit more confusion into the current system than we're clearing up. So, thank you.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And question to the bill's author: isn't there a risk here that if this merger doesn't happen, that that Fairview will go under, and there'll be a lot of people, especially in rural Minnesota, that will be without a provider?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, and Representative Scott, I'm not really taking this particular bill specifically to the Fairview-Sanford merger at this time. This is, that is in flux right now. We don't know where that's going to be going. I think that's something that there certainly is concern about if the merger didn't go through and Fairview wasn't able to make it and had to be reorganized, there's a whole host of issues there. So I think that, this bill is designed to look at the healthcare landscape in its totality and to try to catch these things, before it gets to that point. But, it's a good question. It is an immediate question. And there's conversations going around this building and other buildings on that issue every minute of every day, I think, right now. So I can't answer, where that would fall.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, thanks for that answer. I'm just concerned here that this bill may be causing more obstacles to happen. It seems like the Attorney General already has some pretty broad authority in these cases. In the conversation that we've had, and I've been listening, I haven't really heard a really good reason for broadening that authority even more. It just seems like it's going to be more of a hindrance to healthcare providers who may need to merge just to survive into the future. And I do agree that if what Representative Nissa is saying is true, that this bill has changed the commerce considerations in this bill, if they've substantially changed since it was last in the Commerce Committee, then I would hope that this bill would go to Commerce, and we'll be talking to our folks in, you said it was going to State Gov, Madam Chair?
Yes, that is the motion.
Thank you. We'll be talking to our folks there to see if they can speak to the chair of that committee to see if this can go back to Commerce, because I believe if we can't discuss some of that stuff here, that it needs to go back to that committee of jurisdiction.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the bill is different than when it was in Commerce. There's things like the, and it has three buckets, which I don't want to necessarily conflate altogether. The university assets are sort of one aspect of this bill. It kind of is a standalone section. The part about HMOs is, again, another standalone section, and that is really about, number one, extending the moratorium that is due to expire July 1st of this year, extending that, and then giving the Minnesota Department of Health the opportunity to reevaluate how HMOs function in this state to avoid some of the pitfalls that have occurred in other states due to the conversion issue and the loss of public assets in that regard. So it's a good point that there are three different issues. The merger issue is more focused on mergers that take place from here out, and that we are following the lead of other states in this area, because there's a lot of issues that drive healthcare costs. Mergers are one of them, and they affect all of us. They affect every aspect of our lives, practically. So it is something that other states are looking at, and we should be too. So this is an effort. But the bill is also in process still, and there are conversations about some of the items in this bill, which I'd be happy to share offline with you and Representative Miska and Representative Carroll and anybody else who has questions about it.
Yep, and really the question before us and the jurisdiction committee is whether, you know, is the discussion about the AG enforcement and authority and the data provisions in Section 4. All right, any further discussion to the bill? Closing comments, Representative Gurman.
Just thank you for the good discussion, and I appreciate being in front of committees that add good ideas to this bill from all stakeholders. Thank you very much.
All right, I'll renew my motion to recommend that House File 402 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Next up, we've got Representative Greenman. Representative Greenman, I will move that House File 1831 be re-referred back to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. I believe you have the A2 amendment. Would you like me to move the A2?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the A2.
All right, I will move the A2 amendment. Please tell us briefly what the A2 amendment does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment reflects some input we've had from franchisors about concerns about reopening contract negotiations as a side effect of removing the unenforceable no-poach provision. So it adds an additional provision, which I can talk about when we talk about the bill.
All right. All those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. And I think that this is a much simpler bill than you're probably hearing today. What this does is protect workers from no-poach or no-hire provisions in franchise agreements. For those not familiar with no-poach agreements, or also called no-hire clauses, they're agreements reached between employers to not recruit each other's workers and not hire each other's workers. In the franchise context, there are agreements where franchisees of the same company agree not to hire each other's workers. For example, for many years, these agreements precluded Jimmy John's franchisees from hiring each other's sandwich makers. So let's say you work at a Jimmy John's in Minneapolis. You hear about a Jimmy John's job in St. Paul that offers a better schedule, higher wages, and they're hiring. You submit your application listing your relevant experience as a sandwich maker in Minneapolis. Under a no-poach clause, the St. Paul Jimmy John's won't hire you without explicit permission from their current employer in Minneapolis. And worst of all, as a worker, you won't even know why you weren't hired. These agreements limit the job options for Minnesota workers, and what's most troubling about them is they're done above the heads of workers. Employees never see them, they never sign them, but they could be turned away from a job because of them. These agreements have been common in the franchise context, and they have a detrimental impact on worker earnings. In 2016, it was estimated that approximately 60% of franchises had some kind of agreements in place. While litigation has been, in more recently, intended to stop the use, has actually led to some bigger franchises stopping using these clauses, others have not. And it's important here in Minnesota to draw a clear line in statute that these restrictive employment clauses are prohibited. This bill would do that. And it would ensure that the clauses do not continue to hurt workers after we pass this bill by requiring that no-poach clauses are either removed from the contracts or, and what we just added with amendment, requiring employers to sign a memorandum of understanding acknowledging that these provisions are void and enforceable, and it requires employers to give notice to their employees. No-poach franchise agreements are unfair to workers. They restrain the free market, the free flow of labor, and they should be prohibited. It was a long night last night, but I'm trying to get my words out. With that, Madam Chair, that's what this bill does, and I look forward to the discussion.
All right. I don't have any testifiers signed up. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is not something that I've heard a lot about. Is this a really prevalent problem right now?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for that question. You know, in 2016, there was research that showed about 60% of franchise agreements had these clauses. More recently, there were some academic studies that actually led to some litigation in Washington State and other places, and a settlement agreement that I actually think Minnesota was a part of with some of the bigger national chains to take these out. But it has been 60% of franchise agreements is a big problem. I think what this bill does is say, draw a clear line in Minnesota law, help remove that language from contracts, and if folks don't want to open up their contracts to remove it, sign a memorandum of understanding to say, this provision is unenforceable.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my concern is we've got, this is broad, we've got businesses like a Jimmy John's, a franchise, a Jimmy John's, sandwich place, and then we've got larger businesses that are a little more sophisticated, you know, financial planning services and those sorts of things where, you know, there's a little bit of a difference in the employees' level of education and probably higher earning and that sort of thing. So I'm just wondering how that translates from like a smaller situation like the Jimmy John's versus a larger company that's a little more sophisticated.
Representative Greenman, and I think Jimmy John's is probably pretty sophisticated with how many businesses they own. Go ahead, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Lead Scott. And I think it is a good point because it doesn't really matter how sophisticated the employee is because they're never party to this contract. This is a contract between the franchisor and the franchisee. The workers, in almost all cases, never even know it exists. So whether you are sophisticated, you know, financial planner, or you work at a Jimmy John's, you don't know that there's a clause in a contract between two employers that says they can't hire you. So if you're not hired at that financial planning place down the street, you would never know that. And so I actually don't think it in this context really matters. It's different from the conversation about a non-compete where the workers are actually one of the participants to the contract. In these cases, it's actually a contract that the workers aren't party to.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. And then, so what's the enforcement mechanism on this?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the subdivision 4, it adds it to the labor standards and wages enforcement of DLI.
Thank you.
Representative Scott. Any further follow-up? Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker, Finn, Representative Greenman. I'm just wondering, you talk about the contracts between this franchise and this franchise. Is it between the franchises, or is it the policy of the corporate itself in order to get franchises to come in? Because I know in a number of different franchises I've looked into purchasing, which thankfully I never did. But I know my brother-in-law and sister-in-law had some franchises, and they had to purchase the franchises for their particular industry that they were in, but it wasn't the between different franchises. If the owner had one, they could move them or move the staff around as needed in the multiple different spots, but at the corporate level they had it set up that way and not at the franchisee level.
Representative,
so how would this bill affect that?
Representative Johnson, you keep. If you're going to ask, I will come back to you. That's typically how we do this. I come back to you guys. I'm not one of those committees that gives you one crack at it. But if you're going to ask a question and pause, let's let the author answer, and then I'll let you have another crack at it. Representative Greenman.
So this is about the contracts between a franchisor and a franchisee that impact either that relationship or the relationship between franchisees. I should note, and we just discussed antitrust law, if these were two separate companies, it would be clear that this would already be a violation of antitrust law. So if it was a Jimmy John's and a Sbarro's, or two independent companies, that that is currently a violation of antitrust law. This is actually a legal gray area that we're closing, and I think why you see the litigation is likely there's sort of an antitrust issue. What we're doing is drawing a really clear line in statute and then trying to deal with the fact that, you know, most of these franchise agreements are long-term agreements, and there's this language floating around, and we want to make sure that people aren't being held to something that is now that we're going to determine is unenforceable.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, like you, once in a while, I also pause before I continue.
I don't ask questions, not calling somebody. Representative Johnson.
I understand what you're trying to do here, but I also know there's businesses that have policies, especially in the bar industry, where you hired in one bar, and because of things going on in that bar and what makes that successful, they do not want the bartenders going to a different bar, because a lot of people follow the bartender around and working in two different places at once. So that's why I was a little concerned.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think what we're talking about is the ability of businesses to restrict and to collude to prevent people from being hired. And so when we talk about the antitrust law, what we're trying to do is make sure that there's a free market for labor, that people can go and move from one bar to another if they can get offered better wages or better hours. That's just how our labor market works. The reason that this is important is because there's the relationship between the franchisor and the franchisee is a specific one, and it's usually opaque and pretty invisible to the workers themselves. And so what we're doing here is just drawing a clear line and making sure that workers in these environments aren't prevented from being hired at a place that they may be well suited to be hired for, and trying to keep the free market for labor.
Representative Nissen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Greenman. Thank you for coming and talking to me about this bill yesterday. That last explanation actually kind of covers a little bit of what I was going to say, which is I agree with you that there does seem to be a problem that this bill is getting at. When competitors in a marketplace collude, stores of franchise B, I think we've maybe picked on a couple of franchises a little bit more than we need to in particular, but that would be clearly an antitrust problem, and to the extent that this is helping to clarify that in those kind of situations, I think it's a good thing. If there are folks out there who do have concerns about the way this language works and have some ideas about how it could be fixed, and or there might be some unintended consequences, I would love to hear about that, and I would love to work with you, Representative Greenman, on any of those things. I appreciate the point that this bill is getting at, that competitors in a marketplace should not be colluding, and if they're independent businesses that are franchisees of a franchisor, those are all independent businesses still, and they shouldn't be able to use those contractual relationships to get around the antitrust laws. And so I do appreciate the general purpose of this bill. I'm not sure yet whether I support it. I'm genuinely asking for anyone who might not have come to this committee but who has concerns to let me know if there's something that I'm missing about the bill. But I think it's a step in the right direction at the very, very least. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Representative Niska. And I think, you know, we had a great conversation in labor, and it passed with unanimous support. And I think because it's just sort of intuitive, and that we all want to make sure that there's a free and fair and competitive market. The thing I didn't mention, we talked about in labor a bit, is the research shows that it's about a 4% penalty when these contracts exist on wages. And there was sort of this natural experiment given what happened in Washington State. And so there is actually an impact on wages that's reflected of this, what I would say is anti-competitive agreements. And so I do think it's a good opportunity here in Minnesota to do something that the law is going towards anyways, but do it in a way that creates a really clear line and creates some actions that I think franchisors and can take to make sure that both our franchisees and workers know what the law is. And so I'm happy to that this is going the labor omnibus bill. Looking forward to continue the conversation and working on it. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask for your support.
All right, I'll renew my motion to recommend that House File 1831, as amended, be referred back to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Next up, Representative Curran. I will move to recommend that House File 2290 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Well, actually, Representative Curran, would you like to move?
Yes, so moved, Chair. Thank you.
All right. And then would you like to move your A2 amendment?
Yes, Chair, I would like to move the A2 amendment and explain.
Yep, please.
Thank you. So thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee, for hearing this today. The A2 amendment before you comes from discussions, particularly a discussion that I had with the BCA recently, where they expressed concerns surrounding vehicle searches, where there had been a precedent established in the courts where they were relying on the no-knock warrant in order to search vehicles. From that conversation, I felt that warranted a change based on the difference in the reasonable expectation of privacy that we have that's different between one's own private dwelling and a vehicle. Certainly, if that vehicle is a person's home, we might knock on the window to alert them that we're there to search it. Otherwise, I think this is changing premises to dwelling gives clearer guidance to courts that we are looking at dwellings versus vehicles that we might be searching or other types of what might be a premises. The other section of this amendment regards the execution. This adds an enforcement provision to the bill that's not punitive. This language is quite intentional because it really puts the focus on cleanly and safely solving crimes in a way that balances trust and constitutional rights. It would also enhance accountability. So it would suppress evidence that would be obtained in violation of the bill.
All right. Any discussion to the A2? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Curran, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. So I'll start with the context of the Constitution. I discussed this a little bit in public safety, but we know that the Constitution has really held up and stood the test of time. And that's my intent to do when we're looking at this bill with the very intentional amendments that have been made along the way, that hopefully we can come to a place where this also strikes a balance that will hold the test of time. Over time, we have become accustomed to some laws that arguably infringe on some of those constitutional rights that we have in one way or another. And I know that we don't always agree when that is the case or which give and take is worth it. But I think we all agree that our Fourth Amendment right to freedom from unlawful search and seizure, that gives us our very personal and crucial right to privacy. That privacy without fear of sudden government intrusion or criminal act. We have laws that protect us from those things. These laws uplift our constitutional right to peace in our own homes. Today I'm here to ask the committee a question. Is the collection of evidence worth death when we can avoid it? We know that emergencies do not require warrants. Exigent circumstances allow law enforcement to pursue without a warrant. That's because we know in an emergency for certain what the right thing to do is. It's to protect, to save, and to get everyone home safe. What we're discussing today pertains specifically to search warrants. I recognize that a total prohibition on no-knock warrants has not always been the most well-received idea, and I have to admit it took me a long time to decide which version of this bill to introduce, and I took a lot of time and had a lot of conversations when moving forward with the amendments to get it in the shape it is today. But I'm asking the committee here today to reframe the way that we think about this issue. This is about our rights. It's also about our right to know for certain that when someone enters your home unannounced, you don't need to second guess if that person might be a police officer. Your right to protect your home, your privacy, cannot be taken from you. And I think we really need to dig deep when we ask ourselves what we're willing to pay for the pursuit of evidence. Because I don't really think that answer includes the lives of police officers or innocent bystanders or people who are in the right place but on the wrong sheet of paper. I will point members, we did have a letter from the ACLU in support, and I won't read the full letter, but I just wanted to note one point here that they made, that no-knock warrants create a no-win situation where everyone can be right and harm still occurs. And I think that's crucial when we're talking about our constitutional rights and what no-knock warrants or how no-knock warrants conflict with that. You'll also notice there is a joint letter from law enforcement organizations, and I will just point to a section here that that says, you know, as identified in the law, the intent of present statutory language is to prevent loss, destruction, and removal of objects. I'm not debating that. I'm not debating that that is the current intent. But what I'm saying today is that that intent is not always reflected by the outcome that we've seen. In the next paragraph, I will disagree with that. That you know, this letter says that the proposed amendments to the statute significantly limit law enforcement ability to avail themselves, and I wholeheartedly disagree with that, because I think this actually provides more clarity and more protections for people in their own home. And as amended, this, like I said, puts the focus on solving crimes, but not at the expense of constitutional rights and unnecessary risks. I understand there's going to be questions today, hypotheticals, probably layered hypotheticals, and I look forward to our discussion. But before you ask, I just ask that you take a pause and ask yourself if that evidence in the search warrant is really worth putting officers and innocent people in serious danger. Is that evidence truly worth impeding our rights to privacy in our own homes? Because we are all one fake credit application or one case of mistaken identity away from getting caught up in a situation where we are in the right place, but we are on the wrong sheet of paper. Now, I would ask that you please consider the next testimony as you weigh the true importance of entering a home unannounced when no one is inside in imminent danger for the purpose of searching and collecting evidence.
All right, I have Andre Locke, and then I have Linda K. Tyler on the list as well. And Ms. Tyler, if you'd like to sit at the table, that would be great.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me. Representative, thank you.
Go, please introduce yourself for the record, yes. And then go ahead with your testimony.
I am Andre Locke, the father of Amir Locke. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2290, the prohibition of no-knock warrants in Minnesota. I implore you to vote in favor of this legislation. My son Amir Locke mattered. He was 22 years old and was laying the groundwork for a meaningful life, helping make the world a better place. And now we have to do that in his name. He was a beautiful son. He had a great sense of humor, a loving smile. He loved music. He was truly loved. In the early morning hours of February the 2nd, 2022, a little more than a year ago, Amir was awoken by a no-knock warrant executed by the Minneapolis SWAT team. Amir was not named in that warrant, not suspected of any crime, and was a guest in the residence where he was sleeping. Upon being woken up by the invading SWAT team, Amir reached for his handgun, demonstrating and responsible handling by keeping the gun pointed down, keeping his finger off of the trigger, and never raising the weapon in direction of any officer. Minneapolis police, without warning, denied my son the ability to assess the situation and disarm himself, fired three shots, while Amir was still covered in a blanket on the couch where he had been resting peacefully. Within 10 seconds of the SWAT team entering the apartment, Amir was gone. No-knock warrants like the ones that resulted in Amir's senseless death are an issue that Minnesota and our nation needs to deal with. We've seen over and over again across the country, in which these raids result in unnecessary damage and injury and death. We call upon our leaders to do the right things and eliminate or significantly restrict the militaristic approach to police in our communities. Representative Omar has introduced the Amir Locke No-Knock Warrants Reform Bill in Congress, and now these brave lawmakers here in Minnesota are stepping up to do the same thing and help save lives. Minnesota has a responsibility to ensure police officers for their citizens. Minnesota has a responsibility to each of their citizens, I do apologize, to ensure police officers are properly trained under and understand how to de-escalate interactions with civilians while valuing human life. This tragedy was avoidable if the city abided by its promise to cease performing these dangerous, unnecessary no-knock warrants. Shooting a mirror under these circumstances without warning or opportunity to comply is unreasonable force under the Fourth Amendment. Our hearts are broken, and there is nothing in the world that will make this better. Amir was a beautiful 22-year-old man with his whole life to be lived, and we'll never know his contribution, how it would have made this world a better place. We now fight for justice in his name and hope Meeting for Change will be his legacy. I want to thank you all for your support of this life-changing legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Sorry for your loss. I think impressed by your strong testimony today. So thank you very much. Ms. Tyler, if you want to introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to pull this chair up here because it signifies an empty seat, because that's what's happened at our home. At every holiday, at every birthday, ever since 2/2/22, there's an empty seat. It is a goal of every officer to make it home every night. That is equally true of every black mother and father, to make sure that their child makes it home safely. So what do you say to a mother and father whose child is killed in their home while sleeping? Eliminating no-knocks will increase the chances of officers making it home safely and increase the chances of people feeling safe in their homes. Andre Locke Sr., who you just heard from, taught Amir 10 and 2. Whenever you come in contact with an officer, place your hands on the wheel at a 10 and 2. Make it visible so that you can make it home safely. He gave him the talk. Be respectful when you come in contact with an officer. Make it home safely. But he didn't prepare him on how to be safe in his home. And the reason that he didn't is because the Fourth Amendment already did. And when Amir was of age, he sought to protect himself and to protect his property. He took gun courses to learn how to operate a firearm. He researched various guns. He got his license. He looked at what he needed to do in order to make sure that he was compliant. His constitutional rights was violated. No-knock warrant for property, a violent invasion of one's home for property. I remember seeing a video of Amir the night before his death. He was smiling and he was cooking his favorite meal in the kitchen. I think of that vision often because his favorite meal was spaghetti. But I don't think that he thought his favorite meal that he was cooking would be his last meal. I need for each of you to lay down your political affiliations and pass this bill, HF 2290, because it's the right thing to do. A house divided cannot stand, and a house violently invaded ends in death. After Amir's death, I remember my sister saying to me, I watched over my son all his life. I was protecting him when he was sick, when he got in trouble, and it haunts her till this day that she couldn't be there for him to protect him. Behind no knocks, there may be criminals or property in the case of my nephew, but there are also women, children, and innocent persons just sleeping. When do we become a society that we value occupation over the sanctity of life? We are making advances in medicine. There is new technology that's coming out all the time, but we can't make new advancement in policing that would allow all parties, not just my nephew, but all parties to be safe. No-knock warrants are designed to help the officers, but who's helping the citizens? Who is protecting the citizens? By passing this legislation, you protect all the parties involved, those who issue the warrants and those who receive them, those who voted for you and those you wanted to earn their votes, ensuring that everyone, police officers and my nephew, can go home safely. St. Paul Police didn't believe that warrant needed to be a no-knock. They issued a knock warrant. Imagine if the police would have knocked, told the resident that they have a warrant to search the property. I wouldn't be talking about Amir in the past tense. He would be sitting here. Imagine if Mayor Fry had stuck to his campaign promise and banned no-knocks. I would not be sitting here in front of you testifying about my nephew. Imagine if you would have passed this legislation in 2019, 2020, or any year prior to 2022. Amir would be right here. No-knocks leave people desolate, homeless, and broken. And in my case, a death. There is nothing positive about a no-knock that leaves mass destruction and pathways both emotionally and physically. When the law to bring this law, even if you pass it, will not bring Amir back, but it will prevent another family from having to deal with what we're dealing with, and it would also allow people to wake up, not to mayhem and gunfire. No more empty chairs at the dinner table. No more empty chairs at holiday gatherings. No more empty chairs. I ask that you pass this bill and that you protect the state of all your citizens and you give them the opportunity to be able to sleep in their house under a blanket. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm not sure if I got your full name on the record.
I'm sorry. If you could just. I am Linda K. Tyler, and I'm Amir's auntie.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up on the list, I have Jonathan McClellan. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jonathan McClellan, President of the Minnesota Justice Coalition. I would like to thank Representative Curran for caring and this committee for hearing this common sense piece of legislation that will reform no-knock search warrant law by protecting the community and public servants alike with best practices. In 2012, when I was serving on duty as a Minneapolis firefighter, I received a call from my children saying the police were at my home. The police were getting ready to serve a warrant for an individual who used the address sometime in the past before I purchased the home. The police came inside my house and my kids were scared. Once the police officers realized that the person they were looking for did not live there, they left. I found out the next day that the warrant was for a person on probation subject to a probation violation, and the address on the warrant was not the address the probation office had. I asked if law enforcement ever verified the name and address with the probation office, and I was told no. This was a situation where one of my kids could have lost their life on a warrant with misinformation. Law enforcement did apologize, but apologies don't correct the problem. Legislation does. Minnesota Statute 626.14 Subdivision 3 are the requirements for a no-knock search warrant. There are four main steps that need to be taken to get a no-knock warrant here in the state of Minnesota, as I understand it. One, a sworn affidavit that shows probable cause. The affidavit must include why a no-knock is needed as opposed to a knock-and-announce warrant. Two, what investigative activities have taken place to support the issuance of the no-knock warrant. Three, whether the no-knock warrant can be executed during daylight hours. And four, the chief law enforcement officer or their designee and a supervisor must review and approve a no-knock warrant. What a no-knock warrant in its current state does not discuss or consider is innocent people that might be in the home, such as children, elderly, or vulnerable individuals, the mental health concerns, cognitive or physical disabilities of the people residing in the home. Last session, when we heard the no-knock legislation, I testified and used the Breonna Taylor case as one of my many examples of no-knocks gone bad, and it was stated that this ain't Kentucky. In less than a year from that testimony, we were faced with the tragic loss of Amir Locke, who was 22. He was not the subject of the warrant that took his life in a no-knock warrant gone bad. This should send chills down our spine that a person could be shot in their homes while waking up from sleeping on the couch or laying in their bed with no warning. Amir Locke died not knowing what happened to him or why. His life ended February 2nd, 2022. Let's not wait for another Amir Locke to do the right thing. This should not be a partisan issue. The tools we give police need to evolve. The community's interests is not served with no-knock warrants, nor is public safety served. We need to identify best practices and make policy changes for the greater good of all Minnesota. Banning no-knocks is the right thing. The Minnesota Justice Coalition supports House File 2290, and we ask you to as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The only other member of the public I have signed up is Dave Zimmer. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Zimmer. I am a retired police officer serving 33 years in local law enforcement. I'm also a policy fellow now in my retiree status as a policy fellow with Center of the American Experiment. In my capacity as a law enforcement officer in 33 years, I served 20 years as a detective, executing a number of search warrants in that time. I also served 14 years as a tactical officer, four of those years being a tactical commander, so I was responsible for overseeing the execution of search warrants. It has been my experience in those 33 years that the use of no-knock entries, when necessary and when vetted and managed properly, offer both citizens and the police the safest and most effective route for securing a dwelling. The data and anecdotal experiences are actually quite clear on this. Because of my limited time, I will follow up with each of you with some data and experiences. As a former tactical commander, I know firsthand the importance of conducting operations using sound practices. A blanket ban on the ability for law enforcement to obtain a no-knock authorization from a court is ill-advised, and a ban will put officers and the public at more risk, not less. I urge you to continue debate on this bill. An amendment that would place well-crafted restrictions on the use of no-knocks rather than an all-out ban would represent a far more appropriate solution to the concerns of all stakeholders in this very important issue. And I would be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Not seeing any representative.
My name is Andrew Tyler. I'm Amir Locke's uncle. Just really quick, I just wanted to share this with you guys. Florida, Oregon, Tennessee, and Virginia. They've all banned no-knock warrants. These are the states. You guys can be the fifth. There's a gentleman in Texas by the name of Marvin Guy. 8 years later, he's in a prison cell right now because of a no-knock warrant. He hasn't even had a hearing. Marvin Guy was coming out of the bathroom, and a no-knock warrant was issued. Someone was coming through his window. An officer came through his window. He shot twice. 41 bullets later, the officer that was shot was killed. Three other officers were shot. I'm not saying it was friendly fire because the ballistics are not found in the case. What I'm telling you is that no-knock warrants in that case didn't work. Breonna Taylor, 9 bullets later, her boyfriend that was in the bed with her, he shot. He didn't know who was at the door. 9 bullets later, Breonna Taylor is dead. Amir Locke, my nephew, numerous bullets later, he's dead. Who does this help? So my question is real simple. Why? Why have the no-knock in the first? And I understand what the gentleman was saying before me and how, you know, this could be disproportionately effective. But I kid you not, this is affecting people. Mr. Guy is still alive. He hasn't had a hearing. There's been a gag order on his attorneys. They don't even want to talk about the case. It took a major march, September 25th of last year, for them to even come forward and talk about the Guy case. They had to do a documentary on it. All I'm saying to you is that this does not help anybody, and that man is alive in a jail cell down in Texas, right? So are we covering it up 41 bullets later? What are we doing? So I just wanted to share that, and thank you so much for allowing another member of the public to come forward, especially him as my nephew. God bless you all. Thank you for whatever outcome that you have here. But I just wanted to make sure I shared that. Become the fifth state to pass this thing. Make it so that no-knock warrants are not used in the state of Minnesota. It's real simple. Just please. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your advocacy. So one other hand go up. You'll be the final public testifier. Please come on up. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Joe Lico. I'm the Sheriff of Dakota County Sheriff's Office. I'm here to speak on this House File 2290, the amended version, on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police. A little background of myself. I have 25 years of experience in the profession. Throughout my years, I was a drug task force investigator as well as overseeing the drug task force. The number of years there is 7 years and 11 years as a SWAT team member and operator. Many of those times I was in the front of those lines when we were executing search warrants. I have overseen and executed hundreds of search warrants in my time. We understand that there's a very dangerous situation when you're walking up to the door, whether you're knocking or not knocking. It's used very sparingly as far as no-knock warrants, in my experience, on a SWAT team and with a drug task force. Those are very unique situations for very dangerous individuals when they're known to be in their homes, either have a history of history of violence or threatening violence towards law enforcement. We've had encounters with individuals that said they will not be taken under arrest without being in a gunfight. How are we to address that when they won't come out of their house? And we exhaust all efforts before even getting to that point. The last thing we want to do is going to an unknown house to apprehend somebody. It's very important that you have oversight, that you exhaust all those efforts prior to entering a dwelling. I know we have examples of no-knocks that did not end well for the safety and the lives of others tragically lost. I also have examples of knock and announce search warrants that ended up tragically in death, giving time for people to get to their weapons, knowing that there are police coming in, and return fire that cost lives. I just want to take a brief moment to address the amended version of the suppression of evidence. If an officer...
And I'm sorry, I didn't write down your name, but I
I'm
need
sorry.
You to wrap up.
Okay.
I didn't have you on the list previously. So, and we've got a letter from the organizations that you're with. So wrap up, please.
Okay. On the suppression of evidence, that it is required that the officer must loudly and understandably announce is very subjective. I don't know how that's going to be measured, and it does not align with the other clauses of the suppression of evidence on a warrant. And also just the last thing I want to say is the purpose of a no-knock warrant is not to preserve evidence. It's to preserve life. In my experience, for search warrants going in, and especially with no-knocks, it's not to preserve evidence. We don't rush through the house to make sure that the drugs are not flushed. We get in there to secure safely all persons, including the officers and those that are inside the residence. That's the purpose behind the no-knock.
All right. Thank you for your
Thank you.
Moving on to member discussion, Representative Weiss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make the clarification that this bill is not about no-knock entries. It is about no-knock warrants. So dynamic entries are always permissible in exigent circumstances. So if there is somebody's life at risk, as our last testifier mentioned, if there is evidence that that might be lost, if they don't come in without announcing, if there are hostages, if there are lives at stake, those types of entries are always allowed, and they are not implicated by this bill. And so I strongly support this bill. I think it's very important, and I just wanted to make that very important clarification because we had some testimony that I think conflates no-knock entries with warrants. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Weiss. Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when we talk about warrants and such, I guess I'd like to ask the author, how many search warrants have you ever written or executed, Madam Chair?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. I don't know that my resume is part of this bill, but I will say that I won an award for my ability to write an excellent search warrant.
Representative Grossel.
At school?
Representative Grossel, Representative Curran's personal background is not at issue here. You can speak to the bill, and if you can't do that, you will not speak in this committee. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I hear many times before anybody asks a question, I'm an attorney. You've got experience in there, and I respect that. I'm a law enforcement officer, retired. My experience is writing and executing search warrants of all kinds. They're not handed out like candy. They're done thoughtfully and carefully. And like the gentleman who testified for the Sheriff's Association, they are to protect everyone involved. They're done that way. Each application must go before a judge. And under oath or affirmation and probable cause, meet those standards. Under their scrutiny, these warrants are signed. Now, anybody who has ever written a search warrant or had to execute a search warrant, they don't take that job lightly. They don't take it lightly at all. And I'm just, I'll go to some other questions then. I guess the question was asked, who determines the reasonable amount of time for the author, Madam Chair?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. As in all cases involving police activity, what we've seen historically with case law is that reasonable is determined by the judge involved in that case, and we look back at case law to see what precedent has been established.
Representative Grossel.
So I guess this bill really doesn't give a good window as far as how long do I hang my backside out in the wind, knocking on a door to execute a warrant, a knock and announce warrant. The rule of thumb, we gave it several seconds. If you hear somebody running away from the door, then it becomes an unannounced search warrant. Those are the things that the law has allowed us to do. You got to get in there. You got to get the scene secured. get people under control so somebody doesn't try to hurt you or you have to hurt somebody else. There's not an officer in this state who has ever gone on a search warrant looking to hurt somebody. And like I said, and the gentleman said it best, I've been on the front of many of those stacks. Hitting a house with someone who says they're going to kill the first cop that comes through that door. But you do it to try to stop them from hurting themselves or somebody else, to try to bring it to a safe and peaceful resolution. And any officers that ever had to do that can give thanks to the good Lord above if they never had to squeeze that trigger. Nobody wants to do that. You don't want tools taken out of your hands as attorneys, and that's understandable. This is a tool for law enforcement to safely execute a search warrant when the situation calls for it. They're not handed out like candy. You have to be able to articulate the need for it. And the evidence, a knock and announce would be used to secure evidence. Get that evidence. Okay. Let's work. Let's get up. You know the situation is not a threat or has a low probability of a threat. Then you go with a knock and announce. But like I said, you hear them running away from the door, it's been a reasonable amount of time, you can kick that door. But if there is a credible, viable threat that you can establish through your information while applying for a no-knock warrant, then you have to have that tool. You have to have that tool for the preservation of life. On the other side of the door, and on the door that's being from the law enforcement side. So please, I implore you, I implore this committee, take this bill back. Take this bill back, and let's get all of the stakeholders involved. Let's see where we need to make the adjustments. If you got to make it more restrictive, make it more restrictive. Officers will do the job. They will work with what you put forward if you can use that tool. Minnesota has some of the most highly trained and best officers on the streets. I can guarantee you that. Myself, I never lost a search warrant in court. And that is because I took them to judges who I knew would scrutinize the heck out of them, to make sure that every I was dotted, every T was crossed. Why? Because I wanted to make sure that the people that I was executing on that search warrant, where I was executing that search warrant, were safe and their rights were secure. That could be me one day. Hope it never happens. But someday somebody may execute a search warrant on me. So I want to make sure people's rights are taken care of, protected, and these things are adhered to. But don't take a tool away from law enforcement. Don't take a tool away from law enforcement. Take a look at it. See what needs to be worked and worked out, and do it that way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Grassl, I know you were absent the day that I talked about this, I ironically, in front of the committee, but it is expected that we are respectful to all of our testifiers, our presenters, and everybody else in this committee. I'm glad you showed us how you can talk about yourself without attacking other people, and that is good. But moving forward, as I said previously, if folks cannot conduct themselves with respect in this space, then you lose the privilege to ask questions of other members.
Madam Chair, excuse me, but I was asking a question. I was not being disrespectful.
You know what you were trying to get at, Representative Grassl. It was not relevant. You were perfectly capable. You just spoke for a very long time about speaking about your own experience, which you did at length. again, you can go back and watch the committee that you missed that you were absent for, but this has been addressed and there is now a pattern, and I will not allow it in my committee. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out, I don't think this letter is in the packet this time from the National Tactical Officers Association. One of the testifiers talked about that. And that letter, I think, would be helpful to share with this committee at some point as well. And it talks about how the purpose of these no-knock warrants has really not been served over time. And it's really antiquated, and they don't recommend them anymore. Like I said, I think it's a really important letter. And then one of the other testifiers talked about, you know, not understanding what this new language was instead of the actual physical knocking. And I remember you and I, Representative Kern, had a conversation with another officer who was on a SWAT team and said, because of new technologies now, this old notion of having to knock and announce, there are many other ways to announce your presence. And if you could just briefly describe some of those other ways, I think that would be helpful as well.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Mueller, for the question. I will address a couple of comments very briefly. I just want to make clear that I'm not disputing the ability of courts or officers to carry out their duties, nor to establish probable cause when needed. I will say that, as we're discussing now, the first amendment that we had to this bill did remove the 30-second requirement to wait after a knock. So that has been language that we've been continuing to evaluate, and that I feel has been resolved with the language we currently before us. I will agree that officers will work with what we have, which I intend to be the bill before us today. And to Chair Mueller's question, you know, the conversation that we had with the officer about knocking was that we really do see the risk in requiring somebody to physically put knuckles to a door. That immediately closes space between a person and a subject in an area that they may not be familiar with. We know that entering anybody's home, when it, regardless of what the call is, whether it is for somebody who's missing, to take a theft report, to help get a description of a lost cat, we know that stepping into somebody else's territory is inherently dangerous. And so we have other tools, like you mentioned, Chair, and something as simple as a phone call or making that announcement from a few feet away from the door would be something that now would be acceptable and not considered no knock.
All right. With that, I'm going to lay the bill over so we can get to the next bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move House File 181, Representative Vang. We'll move House File 181 in front of the committee. See, no amendments. Representative Vang, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just keep this brief. I just want to highlight some of the sections most relevant to the Judiciary Committee. Most importantly, this bill allows for community reporting of hate and bias incidents and to report that to the Department of Human Rights. There's blank appropriations to the Department of Human Rights, if you've seen the fiscal note, it is $538,000 fiscal year 24, $396,000 fiscal year 25. With $792,000 in the tails. These costs are equivalent to the three full-time positions that the department is expected to need to implement the provisions of this bill. This bill will also improve how the state collects and report on hate and bias incident in order to effectively combat the rise in hate and bias incidents to marginalized communities. There's a piece on how data is collected. It'll have disaggregated data showing the types of incidents and the nature of the victims, but it won't identify identities of the individuals involved. Another section relevant to the committee is allows the post board to update their process to address the training and curricular needs in response to hate and bias incidents. It tells the post board to work with a professional from an underserved community who is knowledgeable about hate and bias incidents to help develop that training curriculum. With that, I believe those are the sections relevant to the committee, and I can be open for questions.
I do have a couple of testifiers of yours. Are you wanting them to testify, or are they just here to answer questions?
Yes, please, if you could allow them to come testify as well.
All right. Brandon and Shorsh from Jewish Community Action. And then I have Karen Wills on deck. And you can go ahead and come on up. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Of course. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Brandon Shorsh. I'm an organizer at Jewish Community Action, and I'm here on behalf of not only my organization, but also the Communities Combating Hate Coalition. Our coalition began in 2019 with conversations between just a handful of Muslim, Jewish, and LGBTQ advocacy groups, as we noted serious issues in the responses to several prominent hate-motivated incidents in the preceding years, most notably the attempted firebombing of Dar al-Farouk in Bloomington. Since then, our coalition has grown to 18 member organizations, and in our efforts to understand the problem, we recognize the need for significant revisions to Minnesota's outdated hate crimes, or bias crimes as we call them, statutes. Our time is limited, so what should legislators know? Well, two-thirds of criminal hate acts go unreported. This is according to the FBI, National Law Enforcement Associations, and civil rights organizations. Crime data is reported voluntarily, and many jurisdictions never report or withhold reports on specifically hate and bias crimes to avoid bad press. Again, this is something that is noted throughout FBI reports from the last two decades. Police departments are the sole source for most of this data that we see, but officers are also not legal and constitutional experts. They have very busy jobs. So many do not recognize when a criminal act does include that bias component. Reported hate crimes have been increasing every year of the last decade, with each year of the last five setting records. Other countries have better reporting systems because they work directly with communities affected and build standardizations for reporting to sift out bad data. Better data lets our communities better see where the problems are. To close with a public health example, in 1854, a wave of cholera hit London, and a researcher named John Snow began to map out cases, and he found that cholera hotspots were all near specific wells that turned out to be contaminated with human waste. This use of mapping and aggregated data is a cornerstone of public health and public policy today. With the provisions of this bill, the state of Minnesota will be better equipped to respond to hate holistically rather than solely through criminal law, as it largely does today. Thank you.
All right. Karen Wills, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Sure everyone's ready for lunch. I'll try to be as brief as I can. My name is Karen Wills, and I live in Bloomington. I am a member of the communities of the Communities Combating Hate and representing the Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Alliance in Minnesota. I was personally a victim of a hate crime, a bias crime. I had a bruised wrist and a smashed phone when I was witnessing the group who was shouting insults at the Bloomington Pride, the first festival. So the pain and empathy that I experienced with people who are being vilified and violated comes from my personal memory of that attack. I formed a group in Bloomington called Neighbors Together in Solidarity, who show up at the Bloomington Mosque every Friday and who are there witnessing and helping to protect against the harassment of the worshipers at our mosque in my town, which was bombed. Minnesota is number one in so many ways for so many positive things, but you might not know that we also are number one in the vandalism of mosques. We had five reported incidences last year alone, and that puts us number one in the country. And there are other incidences that I know about from my friends and neighbors in Bloomington that have not even been reported. And it happens all over St. Cloud, Mankato, Farmington, Bloomington, all over our state. This kind of harassment needs to be acknowledged and mapped, and people need to be aware that it is happening. On this first Friday of the holy season of Ramadan, I am here not speaking for my Muslim siblings, but standing with them. We need to support House File 181. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Any discussion of House File 181? Is this this bill, Representative Johnson? All right, Representative Johnson.
Deal with the other bill later. To the Chair Becker Finn, to the author, I know it's not in this purview of the committee, but I do have a concern with the timing of the date of effectiveness. The date of effectiveness is June 1st of this year. And I don't have it in front of me. The effective date is July 1st, and that is the same time that post board licenses are due for the office. That would take one third, if it's not extended for 1 year to take effect in 24, we have one fourth of our officers that would not be in compliance and could not be licensed because I believe their licensing date is August 1st.
Representative Johnson, can you point to what line in the bill you're talking about?
And it's the post board has to have time to get the license.
Okay, and that's in the jurisdiction of the public safety committee release to the MDHR provision.
I understand that, but it's done with the not in the public safety committee anymore unless it's going back there.
I believe those provisions would most likely be in the public safety omnibus. I encourage you to talk to Chair Moeller.
Thank you.
Any further discussion to House File 181? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have some concerns about the data that's going to the Department of Human Rights, the timeliness of the reports. Could you speak a little bit to the bill's author? Could you speak a little bit to the requirement in the bill from the time of an occurrence, an event that is supposedly reportable to when it has to then be reported?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative, for your question. I believe, I don't think the department is here. I think they'll be most suited to answer this question. What the intent is really, right now, how the infrastructure is set up is that if a hate crime has occurred, the community can only report it to a police officer. Right now, you know, as we've seen during the pandemic, that has exacerbated, and there's the height of the anti-Asian sentiment. Communities don't feel comfortable reporting to police officers, and many times what they experienced are often not criminal as well, and so they're often bias motivated incidents. And so therefore, what the biggest thing what this bill does is really allows the Department of Human Rights to work with community organizations to look at where these incidents are occurring and what those incidents are. And that's really, and the department, if they do get the funding and the tails to hire staff, they will be focused on what that data quality looks like as well.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So can you walk me through a little bit about, you know, you're communicating with these, or the Department of Human Rights is communicating with these community organizations about events that occur there. Can you talk a little bit, is the Department of Human Rights then going to investigate like a law enforcement person would, or I guess is there an investigative component to this, or are they just gathering information about incidences?
Madam Chair, currently the department doesn't investigate, and this bill doesn't look into investigation. It just looks at data collection.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So we're going to be compiling data that's about alleged incidences of bias or hate, but there's no investigation done. We're just going to take every incident that comes in at its face value, and we're going to compile information based on those reports.
Representative Scott, it might be helpful to share that there's when we get to the finance bill that there are requests from the governor's office that would deal with more funding to the Department of Human Rights for things like that. Representative Vane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. It's not hate and bias incidents are not just something that it's as you heard from my testifier, it's very traumatic. It's also very gross. And when we don't address abuse and harassment that has taken place and communities don't feel a place where they can make a report on what has happened to them, we as elected officials don't see how we can really combat and prevent hate from becoming something much more dangerous and much more violent. And so that is really what this bill is trying to address. I guess I don't know how to better explain it. And I could just leave it at that. And we can talk offline too as well.
All right. Any further follow-up? We got 5 minutes.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so my concern is not that you're having these reports done. That's not my concern. You know, I think there's some validity in that. It's what's going to be done with those reports, and that right now, even though given what you said, we don't have the finance portion to this, that the data is not going to be investigated. We have to make sure that if we're going to base data and decisions going forward, even policy decisions here, we want to make sure that the data is true and accurate to a certain point. And right now, there's no investigation going on to make sure that that's happening. So that's just one of my concerns, Representative Vang, going forward. Without any investigative piece that's a component of this, I just don't see what we're going to do with the data.
Any further discussion to House File 181? Representative Nisk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Vang, following up on that, does the Department of Human Rights have any discretion under this bill to decide what are real or maybe not good faith claims of bias?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes.
Representative Nisla.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Vang, I guess that actually gets at sort of my bigger picture concern with this bill. I'm all for prosecuting crime. I'm sorry for what happened to you, Ms. Wills, and for everyone who gets assaulted or even, you know, when it crosses the line into harassment. I am concerned that we're blurring the line between violence and speech or violence and politics, and it goes in a lot of different directions. I have heard from people of faith who perceive advocacy in favor of a lot of the bills that are being passed in the legislature right now as attacks on their religion, for example. And so I am concerned that we are, that this bill blurs the lines and places between political disagreements, First Amendment protected activity on the one hand, and things that, there definitely are criminal issues, legitimate criminal issues that this bill is getting at. And it does concern me a little bit that then the, you know, bureaucrats in the Minnesota Department of Human Rights who ultimately, operate in an organization that's accountable to a partisan elected official are compiling a database that potentially spills over into a database about people's political speech that would be protected by the First Amendment. So,
Madam Chair,
I'm letting him finish.
Yeah. So, I would hope that we could tie the data collection a little bit more closely to things that are actual criminal behavior and less in the area of potentially spilling over into protected political speech.
Representative Vang, real quick, we got 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be clear that this is not political speech is not considered hate. What this is trying to address is hate against a protected class, and so political speech would not be a part of this. Your First Amendment rights are still protected. You can, I guess, if you an example, if you are someone is distributing an anti-Semitic flyer and that's not criminal, but still bias motivated. And that's an incident as well. So I just want to leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you can wrap up, close up, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to have this bill heard, and I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. With that, I will lay over House File 181. Members, happy second deadline day to all who celebrate. With that, we are adjourned.